Well, good day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Dr. Bob Birrell, who is a well-known demographer and critic of mass immigration. Bob was formerly a professor at Monash University and has acted as an advisor to successive Australian governments on immigration policy. He is currently president of the Australian Population Research Institute think tank, which has just released a survey on Australians' attitudes to immigration. Among other things, we discuss the impact of mass immigration on Australia in terms of productivity, social cohesion, housing, and fertility rates, why Treasury has got the forecast immigration numbers so wrong, what Australia will look like if we continue with our current policies, and whether there is anything realistically that can be done. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome, Bob Birrell, to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you, Dan.
Let's kick off with a bit of your background. I mean, how did you originally get into studying demography?
Well, it's occurred over decades when initially I was focusing on environmental issues. This is through the 70s and 80s, and then I realized that the demographic factor was crucial to environmental outcomes in Australia, and that prompted me to turn my attention to what was driving the population growth, which at the time was primarily immigration, and of course has become increasingly so ever since. And so that set me off into a career of focusing as a demographer, but primarily on the immigration component.
And so in this discipline of demography, what would you say are the main points of difference between demographers, people like yourself and then Peter MacDonald and Abel Rizvi, who's a former Deputy Secretary of Immigration?
Well, We've had decades of jousting, that is, between myself and the two you mentioned and many others. But I think that the dominant difference is that those demographers who consistently supported high levels of migration simply don't pay much attention to the consequences of the numbers that are coming in. That they consistently downgrade these implications. There's an underlying bias in there, which I think is held by most progressives and certainly most academic and market economists that growth is good and population growth and immigration in particular, because it adds to that, must be good too.
Right. And so they have been responsible for the immigration policy in Australia largely over the last 20 plus years. Treasury has consistently got its estimates on immigration wrong. For example, the federal government way back in 2002 projected that Australia's population would be 25 million in 2042, and then in a later intergenerational report predicted we have a population of almost 40 million by 2055, but we're going to hit that target much quicker than that. So what's the core problem there? What don't Treasury understand? Why are they making such wrong forecasts?
Well, first of all, Treasury has a mindset in which it approves of our migration because it drives one of the three P's of population participation and productivity. So the more people, the higher the overall level of GDP growth. And from Treasury perspective, this is adding to the tax revenue and is a good thing. As to why they consistently get their estimates and forecasts wrong, well, it's because the main dynamic of net overseas migration, which I better just define for you and your listeners before we proceed. Now, net overseas migration refers to the difference between the number of people who the ABS, Australian Bureau of Statistics, defines as residents who come into Australia versus the number it defines as departures. That's the net of that figure that is the usual focus for debate about immigration issues. Now, net overseas migration has in recent years exploded to almost a million over the last couple of years. And the main reason for this is that NOM is driven by temporary migrants, primarily overseas students. There's a vast, hundreds of thousands difference between the numbers that arrive in Australia on overseas student visas versus the number who leave, who hold overseas student visas. Now, the Treasury and the government, because they don't actually control that number, rather it's left to the universities as to how many they want to recruit and how active immigration agents are in recruiting them, tends to underestimate, certainly in recent years, the scale. Most people, when they think of net overseas migration, think of permanent migration. But the numbers of permanent migrants or people arriving in Australia defined as residents who've got permanent residence versus the number of residents as Australians and former migrants who leave each year is a minor number. The dynamic is temporary migrants, primarily students, and the government doesn't have a good hold on it, and anyway doesn't want to let people know just what the scale of the influx is from that source. So I think that's the main reason why we're getting this extraordinary disjunction between actual NOM levels and projections or forecasts from the government's population office.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, was on Q&A, I think, last night, and he was put some questions regarding immigration. And he said, yes, the numbers have been high, but this is essentially over the last couple of years, but this is a catch-up because of the people that weren't able to come here during the COVID lockdowns. What do you make of that argument?
Yes, well, it is true that after 2021, when there was a temporary hold on the influx of overseas students and some encouragement for those already here to go home, that certainly contributed to the subsequent upward movement in 22 and to agree in 23. But in the last couple of years, the huge numbers of overseas students arriving is primarily a consequence of active recruiting and government policy support. It's not a catch-up.
Right. The most immediate and pressing criticism of the immigration program is its alleged effects on housing and rent. What do you say about that? Some say it doesn't have as much impact as people claim. Where do you stand, Bob?
Yeah, well, there's obviously two sides to this. There's the supply side and the demand side. And just to make a preliminary comment on the supply side, that has collapsed because developers, builders can't afford to produce affordable houses or apartments that can be afforded by less affluent members of the community. So the demand side is absolutely crucial in a situation where we've got a significant slowdown in housing supply. The idea that we should add massively to the demand side through immigration just lacks all credibility. And in actual fact, our analysis shows by far the largest source of growth in the demand side, particularly in rental housing, and particularly in Melbourne and Sydney, where just over half of all overseas students settle. That source of demand is the main source. It's the prime factor that's making rental unaffordable for the large numbers of young Australian residents leaving home or trying to set up a new household.
So you have recently released a report based on surveys that you conducted in December last year, which effectively gauges voter sentiment on a variety of issues, but mainly on immigration. What did those results show in a nutshell?
Well, what we were doing was just assessing how the Australian electorate felt about the government policy of high migration, of letting the market determine the outcome of economic transactions, and how the voting public felt about the progressive values that accompanied that economic agenda and high migration. And on each of those three dimensions, we find that the great majority of voters, that is those eligible for voting, not residents, do not support any element of those programs. There is majority electorate dissent from those strategies.
You have previously advised ministers for immigration in Australia. I believe Peter Dutton and also Philip Ruddock. Why has it been so hard to change public policy on immigration to accord more with community sentiment?
Yes, well, it's true. I did have some input in the Howard government years when Philip Ruddock was the Minister for Immigration, and he, as was Howard and some of his key ministers, were quite sympathetic or open and supportive of immigration reform from the Hawke years, when they believed that the Labor government simply laid out the welcome mat largely on political grounds and opened up the migration program. And they did implement significant reforms in the 3 years, 2016 to 2018, when Peter Dutton was the Minister for Home Affairs. He was broadly sympathetic to the idea of reform and responsive to suggestions of how to tighten up family reunion, how to improve the permanent entry program, and so on. But it's become increasingly difficult, even when you've got a minister open to reform, in at least over the past 10 to 20 years, because the interest behind maintaining high migration are so strong, so deeply embedded within the Australian economy and society, that you almost need a revolution of the sort that's occurred in the United States and occurring in Europe to bring about a fundamental change. We saw that last year, in 2024, when the end of 23, the Labor government, in response to a lot of criticism and some polling data showing that the electorate did not approve of the numbers it was bringing in, did tighten up on the visa-ing of overseas students. And it continued that policy in the first half of 2024. It was quite effective. But the opposition from the interests affected by this, and particularly the universities and the states that rely heavily on population-driven growth, particularly Victoria, they kicked up such a fuss that the Labor government quickly backed off. So by mid-2024, the Labor government had effectively canned its strict visa-ing and was offering to universities and the states quotas for overseas student numbers, which would preserve their existing market share and relieve the states and from their concerns that immigration was about to retract.
Yeah, it seems to me that Australia's increasingly out of step with some of its Western peers. In the United States, Marco Rubio, at his confirmation hearing, said the age of mass migration is over. In the UK, you've got, Nigel Farage is saying he's in favour of net zero migration. And senior cabinet, former senior cabinet ministers like Suella Braverman are saying similar things, or at the very least that immigration should be in the tens of thousands in the UK, which would be very low numbers here if you were to adjust for population size. And yet in Australia, it's hard to see either of the two political parties saying anything similar. Why do you think that is? Why are they far less reluctant to sort of read the room like other Western democracies seem to be doing?
Dan, I think that may be changing, but let me come back to why and go back to the first part of your question about why high levels of migration seem so part of the furniture here. And the fundamental reason is that in the aftermath of the Hawke-Keating-Howard reform era, when our markets were opened up to international trade, and in the process we basically lost the industries that had developed in the 50s and 60s, Australia essentially found its niche in the international marketplace, but it was as a commodity producer. And so the question would come, well, what are all these people going to do now? And especially if we're preoccupied with economic growth, and which is partly determined by population growth. Well, starting in about 2015, when the coalition was in power, and we had the first signs of a Chinese slowdown in demand for commodities, we got a very distinct change in immigration policy at that time, 2015, and it was that we need to push up migration intake in order to provide an alternative for the growth that we were previously getting from rampant Chinese purchasing of our commodities. In other words, immigration has now become a part of our overall economic dynamism. Without it, GDP growth would slow, and we'd either have to turn the tap off or find something for them to do that's actually productive. And there's a serious unwillingness to take on that task because there's so many vested interests now in sticking to that model. Now, it although for some years now, when we ask voters about how they feel about migration and population growth, most of them are fairly negative, but it hasn't had the political consequences that it's having right in Europe and in the United States. And it's partly because in those two countries, high levels of migration are very closely associated with asylum seekers, entry from people from global south, particularly Islamic countries. And that's clearly associated in critics' mind and in voters' mind that to the extent we maintain high levels of immigration, it's going to represent a challenge to the way we see ourselves, because these migrants are thought to have their prime identity in their own community and religions, and strongly identify with events back in their country of origin. So immigration in that setting for those countries is a real threat to voters. It hasn't been in Australia, because since the early 2000s, when we got control over boat people, immigration hasn't been associated with illegality or asylum seekers. Now, that is now changing. This is something we can talk about. But certainly since October 7, the Hamas attack on Jewish settlements, I think we got a new situation in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to go through there. There's been a transformation in our economy. We've opened up, but we've hollowed out all our industry. We've become very reliant on commodity exports, and we're using immigration as an additional source of growth. And then you have the people from Treasury and elsewhere say, well, you know, the problem really is our productivity. We need to lift our productivity like we were able to do during the 80s. What impact does immigration have on productivity, in your view?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that an economy dependent on high levels of population growth, which implies, in turn, a focus on city building and but particularly on the provision of services, health, education, disability, police, and so on, is inevitably going to be a low productivity economy, because these service industries, being based on people, simply don't have the capacity to improve productivity, as has been the case with the mining industry and manufacturing. And so the fact that Treasury and many market economists keep on asserting that we just need more dynamic growth and we can get it by population, and that in turn will somehow stimulate the emergence of high productivity, knowledge-intensive services. I mean, these interests have been saying that for 30 years, and it's never happened. And they can say this because the whole army of economic technocrats have been raised to believe this. They just repeat it by rote, even though it's becoming sillier and sillier by the year.
Yeah, right. And I mean, one of the other perennial criticisms of the existing native population is that, our fertility is dropping. You know, it's terrible, terrible, terrible. We need to do better. And government policy needs to do something to adjust this, which I'm sympathetic to. But what impact do you think immigration actually has on that, on fertility levels of the existing population?
Well, look, it has a mixed effect. To the extent, which is the case, that migration tends to have a younging effect on the population. That is, the average age of migrants tend to be somewhat lower than the resident population. It does put more people in the childbearing ages. But what's been happening in Australia is that the conditions which are necessary for child rearing, both in the migrant population and in the mainstream resident population, have been deteriorating. That is, the price of housing and the widespread sense of financial vulnerability means that for most couples in the childbearing ages who may well wish to have children, they're put off because of the costs and the uncertainties of their living situation. And as a consequence, our measure of fertility, the total fertility rate, which is refers to the number of children a woman would have over a childbearing life as she repeated the current rates of fertility, has dropped way below replacement level. So we still, because of the legacy of large numbers in the childbearing ages, we've still got a positive birth to death number, but it's slowly declining. So most of our population growth now is attributable to net overseas migration, and that will continue to be the case. You know, quite apart from the issue of population numbers, I'm concerned about this, as I think many people are. If we as a nation can't provide the setting to reproduce ourselves, it suggests a failed nation to me.
Yeah, I say, you know, successful nations should be producing children and producing goods and services rather than importing both, right? That's what when Britain was in its heyday, it was exporting people and goods, and now everything seems to be going in reverse. When I raise this immigration issue with people in the political scene, they say, look, the next election, yes, it's an issue. The next election will be focused on the cost of living, which is true. But what impact does immigration actually have on the cost of living, even outside of the housing sector? Because I asked some of my economic buddies about this, and there was surprisingly little literature on that particular question that they're able to point me to.
Well, clearly the inability of our big cities to provide housing to meet the extra number of households looking for purchase a house or rental, that is a major factor. There's a huge disjunction between the two, and that's the main reason why housing prices in Australia in relation to household income have reached record levels. It's simply unaffordable. And so on that simple dimension, since, as I argued earlier, and I think we've documented, that immigration, particularly in the big cities, is the main factor on the demand side, immigration is a crucial factor in our inflationary situation. What we found with our survey was that about 50% of voters feel financially insecure. They're either just getting by or much worse. And when we analyse the situation of this 50% of voters to see what's the cause of this, it's a cost of housing, which is crucial. But most of those who own their own home but are mortgaged are also feeling financially insecure. And, of course, those who can't get into the housing marketplace to buy a home or having difficulty finding rental are in a diabolical situation. So it's a potentially important political factor. Now, we're of the view, like many pollsters, that cost of living is the crucial factor, and is likely to be the crucial factor in shaping people's votes. And we found with our survey that most of those who are financially insecure do not favour the coalition for obvious reasons. They see Labor and the Greens as much more caring and more likely to provide for them in their situation. And so I think there's a great big red light there for the coalition by sticking to its guns and back to basics. It's opening itself up to voter leakage from Labor with its newfound caring orientations. But having said that, we also know from our survey that most voters do not support the prevailing progressive agenda, values agenda, or high migration. Now, as I've said earlier in this podcast, I don't think this has been a crucial factor in shaping votes, but it may be becoming so now, and that's largely attributable to the October 7 at Hamas attack on Jewish settlements, because that has let loose in Australia a florid protest movement from obviously coming from minority communities, particularly Islamic communities. And that has opened up a scare in the public arena, which is that our immigration policies in Australia have produced a divided sectarian society, which is harbouring values, particularly anti-Semitic values, on the part of the protesters that are quite fundamentally opposed to what we like to think of ourselves as being in Australia. Now, I suspect that if this issue becomes a key focus as the election campaign unfolds, and particularly if it involves major reform proposals from the coalition on citizenship, how we define it, how we access it, then it could become a vote-changing issue, just as it's become so in the United States and UK and Europe. And the key point here is that the emphasis on citizenship, which we're now seeing across the globe with the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship and so on, to the extent that elites emphasize the importance of citizenship, that is, of countries being based on ordinary people's identity as citizens of their nation, that emphasizes collective responsibilities, collective duties, and downvalues, or disapproves of the progressive values agenda, which is all about diversity, encouragement for community emancipation, individuality. It's a fundamental challenge to the left of center values and immigration identity, and it could become a vote swinger in as the election unfolds.
If there's no substantial change to Australia's immigration policy, what does Australia look like in 10 years' time?
Well, look, it's more of the same, but I think to get a sense of just how bad it is, you have to look at Victoria and to a lesser extent New South Wales, because both economies are now dependent on population growth and associated city building, huge infrastructure investments and service growth. But in the case of Victoria, the state government simply does not have the the financial capacity to provide for all this infrastructure, and it's going deeper into to debt, and is approaching the point where default is a possibility, as it was in the early 90s in Victoria. Now, what happened in Australia, of course, is that the federal government of the day will have to rescue Victoria by additional support, welfare support for all those who can't find employment, more GST payments, more capital payments to pay the bills, and to a lesser extent, this will happen in New South Wales as well. So it's an ugly outlook.
Yeah. The United States, there's been a change of government, and they have, as you noted, I think earlier on, a much bigger problem with illegal immigration than we have had. Although our numbers are, you know, we have a major mass immigration problem, as increasingly they do too. What do you think of Trump's immigration plans and their realistic chance of success? In particular, not just the wall, the famous wall, but the deportations that he has promised to undertake.
Well, I think that there appears to be little doubt that by marshalling the resources of the U.S. state, that they will be able to significantly slow down the movement of asylum seekers across the southern border, and it's already happening. As to the state's capacity to deport 10 or 11 million people who are in the United States illegally, that must be doubtful. But enormous opposition likely from those affected and all those who support the cause of these people in the United States illegally. But overall, there doesn't seem to be any doubt that Trump's change of stance on these issues is going to have a major impact. We have to remember that net overseas migration in the United States is nothing like the level it is in Australia, at least in relationship to the size of the population. We are the global champions as far as the share of overseas-born persons who are residents, you know, just over 30%, something like that in the United States. And the same is true in Western Europe, that asylum seekers have certainly had an enormous political impact, but at least since 2015, the million or so that arrived that year, the demographic impact hasn't been anywhere near as great as in Australia. Britain is a bit different. The British, despite the claims of successive parties to doing something about the scale of immigration, have really struggled to do so and have sustained really high levels of net overseas migration, 500 to 600 a year, which as a share of population, of course, is much less than here, but it's still very substantial. And it's a reason why the immigration issue has just festered on in Britain, where it would seem that it is probably the most significant political issue in the country and is seemingly leading to a major voter realignment with reform, with this very simple program of opposing the progressive agenda and high migration, has a higher primary vote in the polls than does the Conservative Party. So we await major changes in Australia before we're going to get anything like the situation that has emerged in the United States and the UK. But as I said earlier, I think there is a possibility that something of that the sort could emerge as the election unfolds, especially if the coalition makes an issue of various immigration, citizenship related issues in its platform.
Yeah, I mean, I follow the issue reasonably closely, not as closely as you, but probably more closely than others. Even I am sometimes taken aback by the percentage of overseas-born persons in Australia. And I know chatting with people in the UK, they can't quite wrap their head around it either, because I think London, it's about 30% or more born overseas. But in most of the Australian capital cities, it's close to 50% born overseas, I think. Right? Even, I think, Perth and other...
No,
not quite there?
Not 30s, but... So that is an extraordinarily high figure. And we are an outlier internationally, and it is an underlying determinant of many of the problems of financial uncertainty and congestion, house prices. Immigration is clearly a major factor. It's just that we haven't had the kind of immigration that I've described, which has occurred in Britain and Europe and the United States, that is predominantly illegals coming from minority groups with strong connections to value systems and religions which don't fit well within the mainstream community, and which many people fear once they're established that they will undermine the overall value of citizenship and solidarity that most prize in these countries, and most in Australia also prize. I should emphasise that our survey shows that the great majority of Australians do have a very strong sense of belonging to Australia and of supporting policies which heighten our national solidarity and our collective capacity to do things. And that the other very important finding of our survey was that this also applies to most migrant voters. Now, I remind you that voting does require citizenship, and there are literally millions in Australia who do not have citizenship. So, whereas our sample, about 20% of voters are overseas born, and as we indicated earlier, some 30% of Australian residents are overseas born. But nonetheless, of the overseas voters that came up in our survey, most of these, and they're Europeans, formerly European, European born or English-speaking background born, most of those feel just as strongly about belonging to Australia and about the importance of overall national solidarity and citizenship, and just as concerned about excessive diversity and high migration as are the Australian-born voters. It's a major finding, and at the same time, as I need to remind your listeners that same time that is happening, we still have the emergence since October 7 of a minority of migrants who are coming from mainly Islamic countries who have not yet integrated into Australian society and who are very actively engaging in pressing for the interests of their countrymen, Palestinians and the like in the Middle East. But that relatively small group is making a lot of noise and is causing a great deal of discord and amongst commentators and perhaps unnecessarily frightening them that we've become a country of of many cultures and communities without a common thread. I think that's wrong, but nonetheless, there is a minority which is unsettling that situation and could have quite a significant impact, given that there are underlying concerns which we've been emphasizing about the progressive agenda and migration numbers within the majority of voters.
Yeah, just as you're talking, looking up the figures to make sure I got them right. I mean, the figures I'm looking at says 54% of the people in the city of Perth were born overseas, but in the greater Perth, it's 36%. And so I guess it depends where you actually, you get.
Yeah, there were enclaves where there are very high levels of overseas born. But in any case, 30 plus percentage is unprecedented.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, I looked at some of the figures going way back, and you know, you had a big influx in the 1890s of people. So there's a large, and then it really trailed off. And so by about the start of the First World War, if I've got this correct, the numbers of people born overseas started to go right down to about 10% or less. And then after the Second World War, obviously with the waves of migration from Italy and the Baltics and Greece and stuff, it started to rack up. But even during that time, I think it's not probably as well appreciated that the vast majority of the population growth still came from people having babies. Even during those waves of immigration, it was still, from the figures I've seen, two-thirds or more was native population growth rather than migrants, which is not the case today, right? A vast source of population growth is immigration, not people having babies, yeah.
So,
I mean, why was the Australian immigration program held up in the UK, the famous points-based system, as the one that, you know, the model to be followed? How did we get that reputation for being the best in class?
Well, one of the key thrusts of the Howard era reform was to target the migration program towards those with skills and characteristics thought to provide the greatest boost to our overall economy. And this is what we migration advisors did in that period, with constantly devising changes to the selection system in order to try and produce an effective labour market recruitment process. And so all those innovations that added up to a system which other countries were simply hadn't experimented or with to the same degree we had. So to the extent that they assumed, well, our migration program is all about selecting highly skilled immigrants, then we provided a base for emulation. But as we've been saying in the course of this podcast, that's not what Australia's overseas migration program is now about. It's predominantly based on temporary migrants and the annual excess of the numbers coming in with overseas student visas and other temporary visas versus the number of departures leaving with those visas. And the key characteristics of the situation is that the overseas students who do come in here and get temporary visas tend to stay on for years and years. Their purpose for coming here is not primarily education, but rather using education as a means to access our labour market and in the long term to achieve permanent residence. Now, that's a generalisation. Doesn't apply to all groups, less so to the Chinese. But for the most of the continent of subcontinent of India, the inflows, Nepal, India, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and so on. That is the dominant orientation. Now, we deliberately created during coalition years and turbocharged that in the aftermath of COVID to add to the incentives to the point where the initial Labour Party policy through 2023 was to deliberately convert our immigration program into an arm of our education system. We'd never done that in the past before. It was always considered a supplement, but for a period, it was Labour government policy to do this. In other words, recruit these people from our allegedly high class university training system directly into our workforce. The assumption being that they really were learning something worthwhile in the university system. That too is something of a myth, since most of them have been doing the university degrees, which most maximises the possibility of them getting permanent entry. You've got to have an accredited degree. So most of them have been doing business and commerce.
What about this constant argument that I hear from people who run businesses and the like? We can't find people that are willing to work. That's why we need these immigration numbers to work in restaurants, to work in on farms. If we didn't have these immigrations, we wouldn't be able to have anyone to do the work that needs to be done. Why isn't it working with those record numbers? Why do we still have these massive labour shortages across the economy?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the availability of this huge temporary entry stock of people has reduced the cost of labour in the hospitality industry, in the horticulture industry, and other areas reliant on low-cost labour. And if we didn't have them, we would have to make an adjustment. People would have to pay more. And that's a major factor in the support for continuing the present system. But most people, most advocates don't use that excuse. They're focusing, as you put it, on skill shortages and alleging that we don't appear to have the capacity or our young people the willingness to learn these skills. Well, to some extent, that's true. And first of all, it starts with the universities, that because their preoccupation has been to maximise the influx of overseas students from the point of view of providing for their budget needs, they have prioritised training of overseas students in key areas like IT and engineering. There are more overseas student graduates in those two fields now in Australia than there are domestic trainees, and that's deliberate university policies. But as far as the trade level is concerned, which is a major issue and a key problem in the high cost of building and therefore problems of housing and affordability, the problem here is much more fundamental, that in Australia, it is the unions which have controlled the training procedures available for apprenticeship level, trade level occupations. Overseas people, unless they've been given accreditation at the same level of our apprenticeship training, cannot work in the trades. Very few overseas-born people now come with trade qualifications, and it's not likely to change because the unions are very unwilling to change the rules so that their rules about the apprenticeship training can be bypassed. It's just simply not happening. And overseas students, once they get here, by and large, cannot do apprenticeships, that the rules are, as they're set, simply precluded. It's not because they're debarred, but because they're here on temporary visas, and so it's simply not consistent with the idea of doing a sustained apprenticeship to be on a temporary visa. So we've got a fundamental trade problem in Australia. It's not going to be solved by overseas students unless you can discard the union involvement in this. It's going to have to involve more trade training in Australia.
Yeah. So, Bob, imagine you're put in charge of Australian immigration policy with a free hand. What should be done, ideally?
Well, the first thing clearly is to control the overseas student industry. That's the dynamic driver. That is the basis of most of the vested interests, particularly state government interests, who have become highly dependent on universities as a providers of jobs and something for young people to do. That has to be the first change. We have to get the universities to focus on training Australians, residents, not overseas students. And to do that, we'll have to, it'll require increased government funding for our universities. Now, at the moment, neither political party is willing to acknowledge this truth or to commit to that training. And so as a consequence, we're likely to be stuck with a problem for years. But until that's the first thing and the main thing that needs to happen to get this out of control influx, bring it to an end.
I mean, what about this prospect of that's being floated in the UK and elsewhere of net zero immigration or immigration in the tens of thousands? Is that something we can work towards in Australia realistically?
It's not feasible in Australia because such is the scale, as we've been emphasising over and over again, of the presence of overseas-born persons with linkages back home to parents, to potential partners, to friends and villages and so on, all seeking a way to get out of a situation that's vastly worse than what's potentially available in Australia. If we could get net overseas migration down to 100 or 150,000, that would be a massive achievement in itself, and it would be a huge improvement on the present situation where, as I say, it's just out of control. The government has simply given up, we're stuck.
You're saying, to be clear, that if you just limited immigration to spouses and family reunion and similar types of things, you'd still struggle to get immigration in Australia below 150,000.
Yeah. Look, it's given the scale of demand for this and the linkages back home, to get net overseas migration, to get net permanent entry or permanent entry level, down to 160,000 is a Herculean task. And I think that's why Peter Dutton has backed off that number recently. But that's not the real problem, as I keep emphasising. It's the influx of temporaries versus the lack of excess of former temporaries that is the problem. Mm. And that has to begin with the restructuring our education system, particularly the higher education system, because that's the main source of overseas students, and really, as I said, also a part of the problem because the universities are devoting so much of their potential educational capacity to overseas students that we're starving the domestic student, there's been no increase in the number of commencements from domestic students of the past 7 or 8 years in Australia. Okay. None at all.
Interesting. So, I mean, if I got you right, even if we completely got rid of the temporary ones, it's just unrealistic. We'd still have a permanent migration program about 150,000, and you think per year, and that's still substantial, right? Like that's. I mean, I originally grew up in Townsville. I used to think Townsville was 160,000. All that's now over 200,000 now. I mean, that's another Townsville in Australia per year of permanent migrants, effectively.
Yeah, it's still substantial, but I'm just being realistic. But we have the legacy of this enormous stock of people, many of whom are going to become voters who have very strong links back home. And so the spouse program in particular is highly dynamic and expansive because of the number of people who, when it comes to choosing a spouse, decide to go home, perhaps personal preferences, but family pressures and community pressures. There's a huge potential on the spouse program. And at the moment, we haven't really got it under control at all. Mm. Likewise, for enormous pressure for more parents. Now, that is more under control. The linkages are just so strong. Visitors, family members coming here and then deciding to stay on, and it's extremely hard to deal with these pressures given this background.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't other mechanisms through extending the time it takes to become a citizen and restricting the ability to buy property here, or I don't know, limiting remittances that can be made back to the home country that might disincentivize migration. Is that a potential way of reducing demand to come and live in Australia?
Yes, but we have to keep in perspective, Dan, that the situation over the past couple of decades that we've got to at least 250,000 net overseas migration a year, and that was before COVID. Now, since COVID, the Labor government has simply turned the tap on. We've jumped from net 250,000 to more like 500,000 a year. And with the government, Labor government decisions to retract the tough visaing of overseas students that they implemented in December 1993 and return to the status quo ante and simply provide quotas for universities to obtain the numbers that they've been attaining in peak years, it's put net overseas migration more like 300,000 to 400,000 a year. And this is since they're predominantly locating in Melbourne and Sydney, this is putting enormous pressures on those two cities, and the overflow is adding to the pressures on peripheral communities and the regions now, including Queensland. But that would be a vastly improved situation if we could get down to net to nom of around 150,000.
Yeah, look, I could talk to you all day, and there's lots of other aspects to cover. I just, as a final question, absent such high numbers of immigration that we've had for the last 20 years, have you seen any calculation about what Australia's GDP growth would be over that period of time? In other words, how dependent is our country on immigration for growth, GDP growth?
Well, highly, highly dependent. Most of our GDP growth is attributable to population growth at the moment. And because we've become a service-based society, which is inherently low labour productivity, the main component of growth is coming from population growth. So we need a reset so that we're not dependent on population for our source of growth. And the focus should turn to per capita economic growth, not overall economic growth. I'm not saying that I support this, but at least we have found a niche in the international marketplace as a commodity producer, and it's served us very well. It's provided the basis for our lavish imports, our ability to borrow on foreign markets at low rates, and so on. But it's brought with it major problems of providing for all these additional people. So the logical thing to do, from my point of view, is that we need to live better by making the most of our resource bounty, but doing without this gratuitous addition of hundreds of thousands of extra people every year.
Yeah. Bob, I'm on the same page as you. I couldn't agree more. I will pop the report, quite a detailed report that you've done, hopefully a link to that in the show notes so people can check out the detail that's included in that. And if people want to find out more about your work and what you do, what's the best way for them to locate?
Well, if they go to the TAPRI website, TAPRI, Google that, they'll be able to immediately access all of our research reports and current comments. It's all there.
Yeah. Look, you've been in the trenches fighting this battle for a long, long time and ahead of most other people. So hopefully, eventually, the people in charge with the levers of power, regardless of which political party, will eventually get the idea. Appreciate your time, Bob, and look forward to catching up in future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dan.